I often wondered about the embarrassment Paul must have felt when Eutychus fell to the floor. I try hard to keep the audience awake so I never find out. We're not going to preach any longer than we normally do, and when it's the time's up, the time's up. If I don't get to you everything that I want you to hear this evening, the opportunity to hear me again is totally dependent upon your willingness to dial my telephone and say, let's do some more study. Catering does have me involved in some studies, but the materials I work on and develop are as accessible to you as they are to anybody, and my time is as accessible to you as it is to anybody else. And as long as you've got the time and we can fit it in, I'd be happy to study with anyone in this congregation concerning these things we're talking about tonight. What I wanted to discuss with you this evening is I want to try to, and Terrell is right, and this is how I handle that situation. I loosen the tie and I take off the coat, and if that's offensive to somebody, too bad, that's the way it's going to be done. Okay. As I said, I'm not the full-time preacher here, and you can't fire me, so that's what we do. Oh, you can, okay, well. Yeah, but your wife works for me, and you better know better than trying that. Okay. The fact of the matter is what I wanted to do is many times when we become new converts, our parents assume a lot. Because when we were younger, we heard a lot of the old Bible stories, and I guess they suspect that we should understand where everything just falls into place automatically. If you want to know the true situation is most of us don't know any of that. Our parents don't even know it. Because so much time has been spent on the New Testament, the importance of the New Covenant, which is so very important, because there was salvation in the New Covenant, not salvation in the Old Covenant, and most of us are New Testament Bible thumpers. And therefore, we neglect to spend the time on the Old Testament that's necessary to have a proper appreciation for the things that took place in the New Testament. With the coming of Brother Darrell Cope to Kettering, I had seen this in the last few years at Hillsborough, that basically the knowledge of most Christians are very weak on how everything fits together. And mine was extremely weak, and it's still weak. I've got a long way to go, but I got a better picture of it now than I used to. And it's kind of interesting because you'll get in and you'll ask people questions, and questions you think they should know and how they relate and how it fits in, and they really don't because they don't spend much time in the Old Testament. So what I'd like to do this evening for the next couple of minutes is just try to give you a brief overview, go over some accounts in the Old Testament, and try to give you an idea how everything fits in. Give you some information concerning the Bible. First of all, that book which you read and that you treasure so much, that Bible, the Old Testament, is made up of 39 books. But that Bible, that Old Testament, is also made up of four different segments. Now, what's very interesting, we know it is 39 books, but do you know that the book of 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel was originally called Samuel? The book of 1 Kings and 2 Kings was originally called Kings. Originally, it was only about 37 books in the Old Testament. But what you have now is, for some reason, they have 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel. That's kind of odd because Samuel dies in 1 Samuel chapter 25. He wasn't even around for any of the history in 2 Samuel. But we have 39 books as we know it in the Old Testament. And in those 39 books, there's four different sections. And when you're looking at this, and this is how I describe it to my children in our morning Bible class, and maybe the little ones don't understand it, but my daughter understands it, and I think that you'll understand the application too. If you were going to go down the street and go 75 miles an hour in a car, and a policeman pulls you over and gets a ticket, and you get a ticket, you said, I don't believe I did anything wrong. And you're going to go to court and fight yourself, and you're going to investigate all this, where are you going to go to try to find out the information concerning what you've done? You're going to go to the law. The first five books of the Old Testament are the books of the law. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy is where we can find every law that God intended for the people of the Old Testament to observe. In the book of Genesis, you have the patriarchal law where God spoke directly to Adam. And he spoke to people. And then in the book of Exodus, you have Moses receiving the Ten Commandments. The book of Leviticus is an entire account of every priestly law that God gave the children of Israel. The book of Leviticus tells them what type of garments to wear. The book of Leviticus tells them how to build their tabernacle. The book of Leviticus tells them how to worship, what sacrifices to offer, what feast to keep. Every law concerning God's people that you want to know is contained in the first five books of the Old Testament. So if you had a question concerning exactly what the children of Israel were expected to do, you'd go to Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, or maybe in Book of Numbers, you would find some. One thing I think is important that we understand, there's actually two laws in this section. There's the patriarchal law, which took place when God spoke directly to Adam and spoke to the fathers, and then the Mosaic law. But every law that God intended His people to follow is contained within the first five books of the Old Testament. The second thing that you might want to know is that the next couple of books, or the next several books, the next 11 books, and that's five books, I'll just put over here in notation, are the books of history. Everything that took place from the beginning of time up to the time of Christ that is recorded happened in the next 11 books. So you got Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. And that tells you the things that happened. Now, what is very interesting is that everything that actually took place, when you look at Isaiah and all those prophets, you look at the 18 books of prophecy, that's the fourth one, there's the prophecy. If you look at the 18 books of prophecy, everything that took place in those 18 books of prophecy happened during the period of 1st and 2nd Kings to 1st and 2nd Chronicles. We look at these books that are at the latter end of the Old Testament and we think, well, they were written later and later and later and later. That's not true. What you have is you have a historical account, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in depth. 1 Kings and 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles that deal with all of the kings of Israel. You have the example of the division, and you have the history of the division of the northern kingdoms, which was Israel, and the southern kingdom, which was Judah. It shows all the kingdoms. And see, these people like Isaiah lived in the day of Hezekiah, when he was a king of the southern kingdom, the kingdom of Judah. And then you have Jeremiah, who was a contemporary of Isaiah. And you have all these prophets that lived around the same time. And there's only about a 300-year space between the life of all the prophets, and all of it fits into these two books, or these four books. You look at the book of Malachi, the last one in the Old Testament, and people usually say, well, Malachi was probably the last book. No, Malachi isn't even close to the last book. Probably the last chronological book of the Old Testament is 2 Chronicles. And that's way in the front of the Old Testament, isn't it? So you see why people get confused? Nothing's in chronological order in the Old Testament. They look at these books and they think that the book of Ezra happens after the book of Chronicles. No, the book of Ezra fits right into 2 Chronicles. And these people fit into this area. And what happens is we don't draw a very clear picture of what is taking place. And there's so many misunderstandings concerning the Old Testament. And that's why you see people out in the world today proclaiming that the Lord is going to come again and establish His kingdom for 1,000 years and live upon the earth, because they think Joel the second chapter is talking about right now. Joel the second chapter was talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction that was going to come upon the people of God because of their disobedience. And in 586 BC, God tore Jerusalem down by using the Babylonian Empire to come and take him captive and take him away. And not one stone was left upon another concerning the temple. Now, after 586 BC, when Jerusalem was destroyed, now notice this, the book of Ezra, which is way up here in the front, you know what Ezra did? He came out of Babylonian captivity, he rebuilt the temple. You know what Nehemiah did? He came out of Babylonian captivity, and he rebuilt the walls to the city of Jerusalem. In about 516 B.C. So these books are up here in front of the Old Testament. And some of the books are way in the back. And they're dealing with things that happened before these other books. Well, why is it in that order? I don't know. I have no idea. But we can date the events that take place. The book of Jeremiah is an excellent book because you can set all these prophets, especially Jeremiah, you can set all these books right next to the Chronicles and the Kings, and you can record and parallel everything that's taking place in those books. What you really need is you need a book and somebody that's really got a lot of time on their hands. If you're unemployed and you want something to do, sit down with the book of 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles, and 2 Chronicles, and just lay it out chronologically. It's in order for you there. And then stick all the prophets where they belong in their time space and develop a chronological Bible. Wouldn't it be great? I thought about that. I don't have time to do it. But wouldn't it be great if you could read everything that took place in the Old Testament in its chronological order? Wouldn't that make more sense to you? But we don't have that. Therefore, if we don't do it, it's not going to be done for us. Now, somebody probably has put one together somewhere, and you might be able to find it. It's probably out there somewhere. But you're not going to really understand the Old Testament until you put it in the proper sequence, because you're not going to know what happened and what took place. And I think it's so very important. The other books that I left out here, there's books of poetry. And poetry and wisdom. And there's five books of poetry and wisdom. Job, Psalm, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon. Some of the most beautiful wisdom that God ever gave to man in the book of poetry. So if I just ask you right off the top of my head right now, I'll tell you how easy it is to figure out how to use the Old Testament. If I was going to tell you, where are you going to find, in what books are you going to find information concerning the coming of Jesus Christ? Is that going to be in the books of the law? No. Is that going to be in the books of poetry? Not really. Where's it going to be? It's going to be in the books of prophecy. Now, let me state something to you. Genesis, the third chapter, there's the first prophecy concerning the coming of Jesus Christ. But that's not the focus of the book of Genesis. And over here in the book of Psalms, there's prophecies concerning the coming of Christ in the book of Proverbs. But that's not the focus of the author's attention, even though the messianic prophecies are in there. But where you're really going to find things concerning the coming of the Christ and how the kingdom is going to be and what type of kingdom it's going to be is in these books of prophecy. You're going to find it in there. You're going to find Joel, the second chapter, when he's prophesying about the pouring out of the Spirit upon God's people. A young man will see vision and old men will dream dreams. And the pouring out of the Spirit upon the handmaiden. You're going to see prophecies concerning the kingdom being established in Zion. And what type of kingdom it's going to be. Over in the book of Daniel. Do you know when Daniel lived? Daniel lived right with Jeremiah. Daniel was one of the first Jews taken out of Jerusalem. He was of the royal family. The royal family was taken out of Jerusalem some 16 years before the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. Daniel was taken with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and taken to Nebuchadnezzar's palace and made to live there. And what you have in the book of Daniel is everything that Daniel and his friends went through in this Babylonian captivity. You know where that fits? It fits in 2 Chronicles. Right in there. When it's talking about King Nebuchadnezzar. But in Daniel, he prophesies in Daniel 4th chapter about this head of gold, shoulders of iron and everything. And he says, "Oh, King Nebuchadnezzar, you are the head of gold." And he goes and he says, "There are going to be four great kingdoms. And the thighs and the legs are made out of brass and clay." And he says, "In the days of that fourth kingdom, in the days of those kings, there shall be a kingdom that will never be passed to another and that will live forever. It will not ever be overthrown." So you could go four kingdoms from the Babylonian Empire, Babylon, the Medes. You could go to the Grecian Empire and you could go to the Roman Empire. And in the Roman Empire, it tells you that's when God's going to establish His kingdom that will rule forever. And you find that in the book of Daniel. It's prophecy. You see, you can use it. Now, if I said, okay, now what I want you to do is tell me what feast did the children of Israel had to observe every year. If I asked you that question, where would you go? History? No. You go to law. Who was the first king of Israel? Where would you go? History. I need to have more understanding of the human nature of man. I need more wisdom. Where would you go? You'd go to poetry. Isn't that amazing how God just broke that book down so easy for you, that Old Testament, the Scripture? If we would learn what we're looking for, you could know where to centrally locate it. What you're looking for is either history, law, poetry, or prophecy. And they all interrelate. Now, that is the first step in learning some things. Now, let me just say this. The Bible was written, the entire Bible, Old and New Testament alike, was written by 40 men over a period of about 1,600 years and to have what we have today. And everybody is very concerned about, well, how do we know that the Bible is true? How do we know that the Bible is completely accurate? You know what I say to that answer? You can't know. There's no way you can know. Now, we can know scientifically as much as possible from examination of old manuscripts. But I have people come in, why wasn't the Maccabees included in the Bible? I'll tell you why the Maccabees were not included in the Bible. Because the Maccabees did not historically, in secular history, prove to be true. Everything that you have recorded within the Scriptures, that are recorded within the Scriptures, not only are inspired, but they accurately prove secular history. Even people that are atheists and do not believe in God believe that the Bible is the most historically sound book that there is written concerning human history and about the events that took place. Here's something for you that I really was amazed when I read this. You know, our children, we want to talk about the things that happened in the Bible. You get over to the book of Joshua, and Joshua's taking the children of Israel into the promised land. They excavated Jericho. Do you know what they found when they excavated Jericho? Now here you tell your children a story, and the kids just love it in class. Well, God told them to march around the city of Jericho one time a day for 6 days. And on the seventh day, I want you to march around seven times, and I want you to blow the trumpets, and the walls will come down. Now, can you imagine that? And I even saw it in a movie someplace. They did that. They marched around the city. They blew the trumpet, and all of a sudden, crash, right to the ground, the walls of Jericho fell. They found the city of Jericho and began to excavate it. They found the north wall, then they found the south wall of Jericho. You know how they found the walls? Completely intact. They laid down like that. The Bible count, God says the walls will come down. He didn't mean crash, He means I'll lay them down. And every wall, the city of Jericho, is completely intact, one brick upon the other, laid flat down. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? And people say there is no God. Could you imagine the Israelites climbing over those walls? If they fell down, they were 60 foot high. Can you imagine the pile of rocks they'd have to climb over to get into the city? But it's real easy because it was just like a drawbridge. And here's the wall. They blow the trumpets and, eat, come on in. That's all there was to it. And you know, all of a sudden, I read that and I said, wow, I never thought that. That is really neat. And when you start reading the accounts in the Old Testament, well, another thing that's come up, how many years have you heard that the ark landed on Mount Ararat? Heard that all your life? I have. Do you know there's a land of Ararat, and the Bible actually says it landed in the land of Ararat. They've located what they believe, and I heard this last night, this excites me, what they believe to be the ark, and they have done x-rays of it and everything else. 515 foot long. Now you say, well, how does that match? Cubit is usually 18 inches, but there's different size cubits. And one cubit was 20.8 inches. And it matches the cubit of 20.8 inches exactly, all the measurements they have so far. They actually, the Turkish government has let them go up there. They've taken core samples of the boat. They've got gopher wood. Pins that held the bolt together that was made out of hewn iron. And now they're asking for permission from the Turkish government to excavate the whole ship. And everybody says, it's not a ship. And they say, well, why isn't it a ship? Because it's 6,350 foot above sea level. Now, why would somebody build a boat and take it up there? Good question. If it is a ship, though, we've got a story, you see. And God said that's where it landed. And that's where it is. If they ever find it, that's where it is. But the things in the Old Testament you can find, the archaeologists, every time they find something, they confirm what's being said in the Bible. And it's historically true. I have no doubts. The Dead Sea Scrolls back in the 1940s that were found, they took the book of Isaiah, they found it in a cave, and they found these Dead Sea Scrolls out by where the Dead Sea was. They found these scrolls, and they took the scrolls, they unrolled them, and they compared them to the translation in the current day, and they were completely accurate. I don't think we have any concern that the Bible has been passed down from generation to generation, from age to age, without being changed. When I say that, I'm saying proper translation. I'm not saying transliterations, and I'm not saying paraphrases. When I see people bring in the good news for modern man, I just about fall flat on my face. That is not a translation, my friends. That is a paraphrase, and it has nothing to do with what the actual words in the Greek and the Hebrew were. Now, you might want to use it for a commentary. I would give you another suggestion. Use it to start your fire. It's not very accurate. But the fact of the matter is, translations have remained very accurate for years and years and years. Getting back to what we're discussing, I'm taking your time. Let me just say that when we look at the book of Genesis, and I think it's very important that we understand that God, when the book of Genesis was written, who wrote it? Does anybody know who wrote the book of Genesis? Because, you know, it gives the account from the beginning. Did you ever wonder what old Moses did up on that mountain for 40 days and 40 nights? Do you think that God made him sit up there for 39 days and wait, and then the last day gave him the Ten Commandments and told him to get back down? God revealed to Moses all that had ever happened, and Moses recorded it. The Leviticus, the law to the Levitical priests, God gave that to Moses. So when you look at the first five books of the Old Testament, really, they were written by Moses. Everything that's there is written by Moses. And what you have is you have God's account. But Genesis means its very self, in the beginning. It means beginning. When you look at the book of Exodus, it means to go out. Now it's interesting as you look at the book of Genesis that you realize that this book has so much history in it and a bigger time span than the rest of the entire Bible. One book has more time span than the rest of the entire Bible. Now, how do you know that? Well, first of all, when Adam was born, he wasn't born when he was created. He was created and he lived from the time that he was created, he lived 930 years. And you go on down the generations and generations, and you get down several generations, and there's a man named Methuselah, 969 years old. Now, his father was Enoch. He lived 365 years, but he never died because God took him to heaven. But all these people lived these long, long periods of time, and the reason for that was to populate the world. But this was pre-diluvian, pre-flood. After the flood, God said man's life expectancy would be 120 years, and he stuck by that pretty well. Abraham lived to be 175, but most people lived from 100 to 120 years. 140 maximum. They didn't live very long after that. And you got down into the years of Christ where people lived 50 and 60 years. What's very interesting is I've been doing a study, and this will just really shock you. But you know the elders that were in the New Testament church? Most people didn't live past 55, 60 years old at that time. Very well could have been 35-year-old men. Because in the history, the Israelites, you were considered a man when you were 20. You were considered an elder of the city when you were 30 and were allowed to sit at the gates. And these men they referred to as elders were 30. Because you didn't live to be very old back in those days. They may have been 35-year-old men that were elders in the Lord's church. And people say, well, you've got to be 50 to be an elder. Now, I'll just tell you one thing. We do live longer, so I prefer the men being older that are elders. But when we look at elders, that term used there was referring to a span of life that those people were living, and they weren't living a long span of life. But anyhow, after the flood, 120 years is what was guaranteed. But you see all these people living a long time, and what you have in the first six chapters, in the seventh chapter of Genesis, you have Noah. You have thousands, probably 1,500 to 2,000 years in the first six chapters of the book of Genesis. Now, after you get past the sixth chapter of the book of Genesis, or the seventh chapter, and the flood, you have eight souls that are saved. Now, do you want to know where you really came from? Let me tell you something. I'm not going to do it for you, but if you really want to know where you came from, let me just tell you this. Noah had three sons. He had Shem, Ham, and Japheth. One of those dudes is your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. Now, you have to figure out which one. One of them is. But let me tell you, from these people, all the nations of the world came. And what you'll find is when you get into the book of Exodus, these people had grown so much, and they were so diverse, that they were fighting with each other. And I'm trying to recall right now, and I don't have it in my notes. I believe that Japheth is the Iranians, and moved in that direction as the Iranians. And from Shem came the Israelites. And you'll notice over in the book of Exodus, when they move out of Egypt, and in the book of Joshua, when they go into the promised land, from that point on, Shem and Japheth have been fighting ever since. They need to find a common ancestor and get this thing straightened out. So we want to straighten out, we're going to have to go all the way back to Noah. But honestly, probably every one of us sitting in this building came from the family of Ham. We probably all did. Unless we have some people that are direct Jewish descendants. So the situation is right there, you have your genealogy, you follow them down, and you can follow the people that are divided and made from that. The most interesting thing to me is the time spaces that take between these books. And let me encourage you in your own study to go back in time for your time space. In the book of Genesis, you end the book of Genesis. Anybody know who the main character was at the end of Genesis? End of Genesis? Joseph, okay. You had Joseph, was the last main character in the book of Genesis. Now you get over here in the book of Exodus. When you get over to the book of Exodus, you have a new Pharaoh. When Joseph ends up the book of Genesis here, 70 people come down, his father and his brothers and their family. They come down and they live in the land of Goshen. Now there's 70 of them that go down there. When you get over here, they're so big and they're so strong that Pharaoh is scared to death of them. What kind of time period you got there? 400 years. You ever think that those things just happened overnight? What I think is very important for you in your study is, one, understand time. Where things line up in time. I encourage you, start at the book of Genesis and start all over again and recognize in Genesis you got 1,500 to 2,000 years of time in there. Place in time. Then find out not only time, but where things fit in history. And where things fit geographically. And I want to tell you, if you do that, you're going to find out things that you never knew about the Bible. There's so many things that are contained within the Scriptures that really fit together and that you can understand if you just understand time, history, and geography. When things took place, where they took place, and how they took place, and what area of the world they took place in. Now you wonder why we have all this problems with fighting in the Middle East. Let me tell you why we have problems with fighting in the Middle East. Because God took the children of Israel and put them in Egyptian captivity and took them from 70 people to thousands and thousands. I forget exactly the number of people that marched out of Egypt after the captivity, but it was well over 350,000 people. Came out of Egypt. Over 400 years, they grew from the 70 to the 350,000 men in Egypt. And they come marching out of there. They go out in the wilderness. They wander for 40 years. These people, Japheth's family, had developed all this area of the promised land and his descendants. And all of a sudden, God said back here in Genesis 12, I'm going to give this land to your seed, Abraham. And this is the land I'm going to give to you. But there were people that are already living there. And what happened is Moses dies and God buries him on the top of Mount Pisgah. And he tells Joshua, get yourself down, get the armies together. We're going to cross the river. We're going to take the land. Well, you know who was in that land at that time? The Iranians and the Iraqis and the Jordanians and the Egyptians. And the same boneheads that were fighting then are fighting today. over the same pieces of land. Hadn't changed since then. For the last 3,000 years, the same parcels of land have been fought for by the same descendants of the people that came from Ham, Shem, and Japheth. And it hasn't stopped since it started. And what happens at the end of the book of Joshua? They've conquered the entire land of Canaan. God says, now this land is yours, and it will remain at peace as long as you keep my commandments and you do not marry people from outside your nation. And as long as you keep my commandments, this land will be yours forever. Joshua dies. How long do they have the land? 40 years. And all of a sudden the Iranians, which were the Edomites, come in and start afflicting them again. And then God raised up Othniel. And Othniel fights the battle and takes the land back. They're faithful for 40 years. They fall off again. Ehud comes up, kills Eglon the Fat, and takes the land back. For 400 years, the judges, off and on, fought the battles for Israel to get their land back, the land that they had lost because they'd been unfaithful to God. And you see this back and forth relationship that takes place. They went in, had all the land. God promised them they'd keep it if they remained faithful. They didn't. He took it away from them. They repent. They come back. He gives them the land back. He takes it from them, gives it back, takes it from them, gives it back. And that's the way it is the rest of the time with the children of Israel, because they will not remain faithful to God. And you can look at all these things happening in secular history, and you can line it up with 1 Kings, 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles, 2 Chronicles. You can look in the book of Judges, and you can line it up with secular history, the things that took place. But it will enlighten you to find out how much you can really understand about the Old Testament if you just line it up properly. My 45 minutes are over. This really wasn't a sermon. It was really a lecture on how you might help yourself in studying the Old Testament. And I want to encourage you to do it. The things that are written before time are written for our learning, that we, through patience of faith, we can learn from these people. You know, I talked to my class this morning. How many miracles did the children of Israel see when Moses went down to deliver them? How many do we have recorded? We got 14. We got him taking this cane and throwing it down and it becoming a snake. And it eating up the other snakes. We have 10 plagues that God put upon the people. He marches them out of the city. They see the wheels of the Egyptians' chariots fall off. They see a pillar of fire shoot up between them and the Egyptians. And they see the sea part and dry land appear, and they walk through into the wilderness. They saw 14 miracles that we know of. And the first thing that happens when they get into the wilderness is they say, we can't take the land of promise. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine that? Do you understand why God wants people to have just a little bit of trust in His ability to lead them and guide them? In the book of 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter, probably one of the saddest times in all the existence of God, Samuel was the last judge of Israel, and the people come to Samuel and say, Samuel, we want a king. And Samuel talks to God. He says, God, they don't like me. And God says, Samuel, it's not you that they've rejected. He said, Samuel, it's me. They don't want me to be their king anymore. And from that point on, God gave them a king. But His real plan was that someday they would have a real king. And a king that they didn't have to have because they were born into His family. A king that they would have because of their choice. And that king would be Jesus. And we have that king today, and He is your king by choice. And you can choose to serve the Lord, or you can choose to serve the other gods of this world. But God, from the Old Testament, He promised Samuel, He said, go ahead and give them a king. And from that time on, He promised that there's one day would be a king that men would have because they want Him to be their king. Do you want Jesus to be your king? If He's your king, you're going to submit to Him. And He tells you to believe that He is the Son of God, to confess your sins, to confess His name, to repent of them, your sins, and be buried with Him in baptism. And you can do that tonight. And we encourage you to do so while together we stand and sing.